Hi, I'm Sima Shapiro, the host of the new Contemporary Lifestyle Radio Show for Women Over 40, featuring everything about your health, wealth, children, happiness, and anything else of interest to you, the listener. Please stay tuned. Hi and welcome. Today we'll be talking with a professor and author about the many anti-aging facial treatments available to men and women, the popularity and pitfalls of doing so, and the many new breakthrough treatments just on the horizon. Martha T.S. Latham is a writer, professor, consultant, and active blogger for The Huffington Post. Her upcoming book, Made Up, How the Beauty Industry Manipulates Consumers, Preys on Women's Insecurities, and Promotes Unattainable Beauty Standards, is an explosive expose of the multi-billion dollar industry that promotes unrealistic beauty standards through a market basket of advertising tricks, techniques, and technologies. She teaches business at Diablo Valley College in San Francisco Bay Area. Dr. Jerome Potoskin is not only a board-certified dermatologist, he is also specially trained in the art and science of dermatological surgery. He completed his residency in dermatology at the renowned NYU Skin and Cancer Unit and is a member of the American College of Mohs Micrographic Surgery. A clinical instructor at the USCF Medical Center, Dr. Potoskin is also a preceptor for Lumenis Medical, training physicians from all over the world in advanced laser techniques. So welcome, Martha and Dr. Potoskin.
Thank you so much.
Let's just start by hearing a little bit about your journey to your present incarnation. Martha?
About 30 years ago, I started looking at women portrayed by the media, specifically with an interest in cosmetic products and the way that they're marketed and promoted. And over the years, many studies have been done that have shown that being exposed to this imagery for long periods of time, especially among young female consumers, can affect their self-esteem or self-evaluation. And then I started digging further and further, and now, 30 years out, I'm ready to start writing about the topic.
And Dr. Potoskin, a little bit about your own interest in what you do for a living.
Well, you know, my interest in dermatology was actually a complete accidental discovery. I was in medical school at New York University. I needed a summer job, and I happened to get a job doing research in dermatology, and then learned more and more about the specialty and the breadth of it, and it just, one thing led to another, if you will.
It's probably a really fascinating field, given the changes that keep occurring, correct?
It's an amazing field. It's a breadth of field. I mean, there's pediatric dermatology, dermatopathology, cosmetic dermatology, skin cancer surgery. So there's a lot of variety, and there is constant change.
So let's talk about the specifics of the big B word. What exactly is Botox, and how does it work?
So the big B, Botox, is purified botulinum toxin. It's a protein. It's the same thing that's found in botulism, but it is a purified protein, and it's used in a very controlled manner. It had been used for years in medicine for treating people with spastic necks. It's used for people that have twitchy eyelids and lazy eyes. And in the late 90s, it was an accidental discovery using it for cosmetic purposes. There's a husband and wife team up in Vancouver named the Carruthers. And Jean Carruthers is an ophthalmologist. Her patients were coming to her for a condition called blepharospasm, where they have twitchy eyelids that they can't control. And a lot of her patients were coming back to her, telling her they liked the fact that their eyelids weren't twitching. What they really liked is that their wrinkles were better. And she and her husband were discussing this, and he thought about using Botox in other areas of the face. And they presented a paper, I believe, in 1997 at a derm surgery meeting, and I happened to be at that meeting, and they presented using Botox or botulinum toxin for the what we call the glabella frown lines, or the 11s in between the brows. And it was very interesting, and I was young and curious, and I ordered a vial of Botox, went back to my office, and injected my nurse, and it was like magic. I mean, it worked incredibly well. to soften those lines. It works by relaxing the muscles, and the lines gradually soften. And the analogy I like to use is that if you have a piece of paper and you're folding it over and over again, you're going to develop a permanent crease unless you stop folding the paper. And in your skin, if you keep folding the skin over and over again, you're going to get a crease until you stop folding it, and Botox allows you to stop folding it.
And there are many myths and truths associated with this. Can you just briefly tell me what's out there and what can you say to either alleviate people's fears or to confirm their worst fears? And I guess the only other question is, what are some of the other most common treatments along this same line?
So I think that with anything, when used properly, when used in moderation, people can be treated safely and get great results. And when I see patients who are considering something like Botox, their concerns usually fall into one of two baskets. It's either the basket of, is this safe? And the other basket is, am I going to look freakish? So in terms of the, is this safe? Botox has been used since the early 80s. When used appropriately, it is extremely safe. In terms of side effects that I've seen in my practice, occasionally we can see bruising about 1% of the time, temporary drooping of an eyelid we can very rarely see. I'd say patients will develop a temporary headache about 1 to 3% of the time. Most of the horrible things that you've heard about with Botox aren't even related to Botox. Years ago, there was a off-brand neurotoxin that was being advertised and being sold to doctors, and it was sold at a fraction of the cost of Botox, so there are some people that wanted to save money, but the toxin was designed for research purposes only, not intended for human use. And to me, that's a red flag, that you don't want to go near that. But there were some unscrupulous practitioners that bought it and injured some patients, and you can have disastrous outcomes under those types of settings. So I would say, Botox is used worldwide, millions of treatments being done. I inject my wife, my mother, my sister, so I have no problems in terms of its safety. The other thing is patients are concerned of looking frozen or looking weird. Again, if it's done by a skilled injector, you should get a great result. If you are injected by someone that has less experience, doesn't know the anatomy, then things can get a little bit weird.
And in terms of methods, what is a range of costs for this type of treatment or even similar types of treatments? And how often do people need to do this to continuously not experience the re-wrinkling?
So I would say that the cost really, there is variation geographically, throughout the country. But I would say that in general, to treat one area of the face, such as the 11s in between the brow, that ranges typically between $300 and $500 nationally. Most patients that we see will come in 2 to 3 times a year to maintain the result, and Botox will last about 3 to 6 months depending on the person. And when we inject it, it typically reaches a plateau at about 1 week, 1 to 2 weeks, plateaus, and then it gradually will kind of wear off over time. When patients come in for the treatments, oftentimes they'll come in on a lunch break, they'll be right back to work, so it's not something that requires a significant amount of downtime, and there's minimal change to the skin immediately after. So after the treatment, an hour later with makeup, people typically are back doing their normal thing.
So I'm guessing that things that you can buy over the counter or you see them in infomercials, this is really a wealthy woman's pleasure, that somebody who is really struggling financially couldn't easily partake of this, especially because insurance doesn't cover it. Would that be accurate?
I would say that it's going to be for someone that has disposable income that can cover it. I mean, if you are struggling to put food on the table, then it's unlikely that this is something that you're going to be able to avail yourself to. But I wouldn't classify it as a wealthy woman's treatment. I've got patients who will come in a couple of times a year for treatment, and it's not, their fee is, under $500 two times a year. People spend money a lot of different ways. It's always surprising to me how people spend money.
And let's go to some stats. Can either of you tell me how many women receive treatments of this kind in the U.S., Are the numbers increasing? Where does the U.S. stand in relation to other countries? Martha?
In terms of the number of treatments, it varies between men and women. There were about 3.8 million, forgive me, about 89.7% of Botulinum, and I never say that right, toxin, the injectables are done by women versus about 438,000 by men, and that's about 10%. So it looks like the majority are women who are actually getting these treatments. But I have to say that there's been a jump of about 337% of men are now getting Botoxed, if you will, which is a jump between 2000 and 2014.
And where does the U.S. stand in relation to the rest of the world?
Number one, the United States actually held its top position as number one for surgical procedures, just looking at surgical procedures, but generally speaking for non-surgical procedures, the U.S. accounted for about 21%, followed by Brazil at 9%, South Korea at 6%, India, which surprised me, at 4%, and finally Mexico at about 3.7%.
Dr. Patazkin, how has science helped in this regard, and is it really exploding in terms of those methods and techniques?
Well, I would say that, you know, with respect to Botox per se, Botox itself has not changed since it was FDA approved significantly. It's changed, and we're finding new ways and new areas to inject. I would say that where we've seen the biggest explosion are in fillers and devices. So the injectable fillers, when I started out, there was only injectable collagen. Now there is an array of different fillers we can use. And I also remember when I first started out in the 1990s, we had one laser called the pulse dye laser. Now there are many different lasers to do all different kinds of things to rejuvenate the skin.
And where does the majority of people's money go? Does it go to those types of treatments or creams? Is it evenly divided, Martha?
There was about $13.5 billion spent on cosmetics procedures, and about $8.1 million went to surgical procedures, and then injectables $2.8 and so forth. So most of the money is definitely going into the cosmetic procedures. I would say it's about 58% for cosmetics procedures and the rest for non-surgical. But these procedures actually are dwarfed by the cosmetics industry. Back in 2014, it clocked in at about $460 billion. So a lot of money is going into actually beauty products and personal care products, and these include hair, nail, skin care, fragrances, and toiletry.
Referencing your book, Made Up, How the Beauty Industry Manipulates Consumers, Preys on Women's Insecurities, and Promotes Unattainable Beauty Standards, I know that it sort of paints a grimmer picture of the business and the residual outcome of it all. So what would you like the general public or the listener to know?
Well, I actually have three areas of concern that maybe consumers might want to think about. The first thing is my research is really looking at marketing and advertising practices for beauty-enhancing cosmetics and for mostly the what we call drugstore brands or department store brands. And it's about the anti-aging claims, which oftentimes aren't truthful. And these are include environmental claims, testimonial claims, and most importantly, scientific claims such as clinically proven. And there's been some very good studies that show that in some cases, for example, the anti-aging claim that a skincare product is going to get rid of your wrinkles has been considered about 23% of the time in this one particular study an outright lie. Only 25% of the time would be considered acceptable. The second area of concern that I actually have is that we focus on baby boomers primarily as having an appetite for these procedures, but if you actually look at the statistics, it's being driven by younger women. Looking at the gender distribution of most of the procedures, it's about 5.1 million or 40% of all procedures were accounted for by people ages 35 to 50.
Hmm.
Now, some practitioners have their sights on much younger consumers, and we're talking about under 35 who are going to, say, dermatologists or plastic surgeons these days for something called prejuvenation treatment to delay the onset of wrinkles. Now, while taking a proactive approach isn't bad, it's just the concern is, well, what does this do, for example, to a young person's or a woman's self-esteem, let alone the lifetime cost?
Mm-hmm.
And then the third area is really about society in general. And there was a very good article called Cosmetic Surgery and Cosmetics Redefining the Appearance of Age. And it asked the proverbial question, does the technological fountain of youth ultimately strengthen ageist sentiment? Do we believe aging is a disease and that the cure are these anti-aging treatments and procedures? So those are really the three issues that have come up in my research.
Always because the show not only is for women over 40, but always because I seem to feel like we're in such a zeitgeist of the times that there's so many differing spokes of the wheel that keep intersecting in this place and time to create so much unrest, so much, I want to say, dis-ease. And also I can apply this to this particular topic because so many people are so obsessed with how they look. And 20, 30, 40 years ago, they may have been obsessed, but they had very little they could do about it. And so therefore, they were aging probably more naturally. I don't know about gracefully. But I'm wondering if either or both of you could sort of talk about this place and time. And then, Dr. Potoskin, to you directly, the breakthroughs in medical technologies are just catapulting this industry forward by leaps and bounds. It's pushing. It's almost pushing women into this. Would you not agree?
I would agree. I think that, you know, as you mentioned, there are so many factors coming into play. Martha hit on the younger generation, which I don't see a lot of that, frankly, in my practice. I think it's just the demographics of where I practice. But I think some of that may be, that's been called the Kardashian effect. You know,
mm-hmm.
people see these, you know, icons on TV or the internet or, you know, social media. It really can drive it. You know, a lot of the device manufacturers now are marketing directly to the consumer.
Mm-hmm.
So I find that, you know, my general approach is to really make sure people have realistic expectations, to make sure they're not overdoing it. I mean, I tend to talk people out of things very frequently because they read something and a lot of things are, you know, hyped up. And we want people to have realistic expectations. And I would say that most of the people I see do have reasonable expectations. They want to look their best. They want to look the way they feel. And, you know, occasionally I'll see someone that does have, you know, what's called body dysmorphic syndrome, where they're really focusing on every little imperfection, and we know they're never going to be happy. And those are people that I really steer away from and, you know, try to tactfully recommend, you know, psychological counseling, which would probably be better for them than, you know, anything that I would possibly inject into them.
Mm-hmm.
And if I could piggyback on what Dr. Potoskin indicated, absolutely, the increased focus on cosmetic procedures is related to this ongoing pop culture obsession with body image. Particularly younger people really get dialed into treatment awareness through popular media. In fact, there was a study done that said, showed that 41% of women aged 16 to 24 learn about treatments from reality TV shows, whereas
mm-hmm.
older women, women like myself who are aging baby boomers, we learn from news reports, magazines, and very often through word of mouth.
So you talked about psychological treatment. In real time, how many times do you suggest this to people? Do you often suggest it, Dr. Potoskin?
I would say infrequently, because usually we try and set the expectation for the patient. We might kind of talk them out of certain things that they might be interested in, but sometimes it's delicate. You're seeing someone for the first time, and they're interested in bunch of cosmetic treatments. Sometimes it's not appropriate that first interaction to say, hey, you need to see a therapist.
Mm-hmm. What do you say to someone who would like to look like Ally McGraw or any of the Kardashians? What do you actually say to them?
So, you know, that's really unrealistic expectations. And I tell people that our goal is to have you looking like the best version of you. We can't make you look like someone else. And that's really where it becomes a perversion of the art when people attempt to do that.
Martha, how does a person know whether these claims that they're reading or hearing or seeing on TV are true? Where can they go to do their own homework to figure out what is the best cosmetic product for them?
Well, I think it's very hard to find out where to go because, first off, again, a cosmetic is not regulated by the FDA. For example, let's look at cosmeceuticals. Cosmeceuticals, that's a marketing term. It's not a drug. It's most like a cosmetic. For the most part, a consumer needs to determine whether or not they can find out what ingredients are in these products. Oftentimes, for example, there's an ad I saw recently for a skincare line that the active ingredient was said to be even better than retinol. And it also indicated in the headline, and these are the areas where I have a problem with anti-aging claims, is that it indicated that it would reduce or minimize your wrinkles by 57 or 53%. And then there was an asterisk, and it went down to what we call the mandatories in an ad or small print. And it wasn't really clinically proven because all it indicated is it was a study of something like 23 female participants who said, self-reported, that it looked like their wrinkles had softened.
Mm-hmm.
So this is what I think that we need to do. We need to be very aware of the fact that many of these claims, for example, clinically proven, how do we find out if it's clinically proven? It gets a little bit tricky. We'd have to do a lot of homework. But how are we going to find out if actually the cosmetics companies aren't going to provide us with that information?
Mm-hmm.
That was a great point Martha just brought up, in that these are what we call cosmeceuticals as compared to drugs that are pharmaceuticals. So pharmaceuticals, by law, have to prove efficacy. They have to prove that they do what they claim to do, whereas with cosmeceuticals, they don't. And cosmeceuticals is a, you know, business in the hundreds of billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to the zeitgeist, why do especially women want the eternal fountain of youth? I say that because, again, it seems that so many people are chasing that. And whether or not they feel better about themselves inside, do they ultimately say that the time or the pain or the money is worth the outcome? Dr. Potoskin?
I would take a step back in terms of, like, you asked, like, why is this all happening?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's a societal issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think it boils down to when you look at the difference between men and women, typically, from the time girls are little, they are judged by how they look, and that kind of goes on through life. Mm-hmm. Women oftentimes are judged by how they look,
mm-hmm.
whereas men more often are judged by what they do or how much mm-hmm. money they make. I mean, sure, there's some blending and changing of that, but that's kind of been ingrained in our society.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a big pressure on women mm-hmm. to want to look good,
mm-hmm.
whereas there's more pressure on men. I mean, there's still the pressure on men to look good, but it's not the same as it is for women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Martha, any final thoughts?
I think that, again, it boils down to caveat emptor, buyer beware. Do your research in the event that you are going to see a dermatologist or a plastic surgeon. Do your homework. Talk to your friends. Go on the internet. And an informed consumer will be a safe consumer.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Potoskin, your thoughts?
I would just piggyback what Martha just said. I think that with respect to people seeking treatments in a physician's office, I think that the biggest mistake someone might do is, like, look for a Groupon or look for, like, mm-hmm. something that is cheap. Because I think that with most things in life, you end up getting what you pay for.
Mm-hmm.
And in my office, we always want our patients to get great value, but it might not necessarily be the cheapest game in town.
We've been talking with author Martha Latham and dermatologist Dr. Potoskin about the business of anti-aging treatments and some of the other issues surrounding this field. Martha can be found at www.in2itmarketing.net. Her new book, Made Up, How the Beauty Industry Manipulates Consumers, Preys on Women's Insecurities, and Promotes Unattainable Beauty Standards, will be available. Where can they find that, Martha?
I'm working on the manuscript now, so hopefully in 2017.
Okay. And Dr. Potoskin can be found at wrinkledoc@earthlink.net. His practice's URL is www.mybeautymd.com. Thank you so much, Martha and Dr. Potoskin, for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sima.
Thank you. And thank you to the listener for joining us. I'm Sima Shapiro. And until next time, I hope you take care.